mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk radio.
It's never too early to learn that the government is a greedy piglet that suckles on a taxpayer's teat until they have sore, chapped nipples.
Lars.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Now, here's your host.
Wait a minute. I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This time during an election season, from the Democrats, you're going to hear them talking about abortion services, which most of them want to call health care services. Although it's befuddled me. I haven't gone to medical school, but somehow killing a baby doesn't seem like health care. But that's just me. You can differ if you like. If you want to join the conversation, by the way, it's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and join me in welcoming Reverend Jim Hardin, who's CEO of Compass Care Pregnancy Services, which is a pregnancy resource service that provides its services mostly in New York. Reverend Hardin, welcome back.
It's an honor to be with you. Thanks for having me back, Lars.
Abortion is certainly well covered in the state of New York, if that's what floats your boat. I'm not, I don't like abortion. I especially don't like having the taxpayers pay for it, but it's not a financial consideration for me as much as it is a consideration that you shouldn't be killing babies. But what are they looking at doing now?
Well, New York is the abortion capital of America in so many ways. It's the abortion headquarters for Planned Parenthood, which provides 40% of all the U.S. abortions. You know, it's the headquarters for Danco Laboratories, which provides chemical abortion, now representing 60% of all abortions in America. And in New York, they're forcing all people who have conventional health insurance plans to pay for abortion out of the risk pool from their health insurance plans directly without copay. And that includes, you know, chemical abortion, surgical abortion, I mean, you name it. You know, they are essentially, you know, forcing kind of secular fundamentalism on Christians who disagree with abortion. If you don't agree with their abortion policy in New York, well then, you know, you're up a creek if you want to have health insurance and you're a person of conscience when it comes to abortion. This is similar, I would say, this is like the beginning of the tip of the iceberg. You know, that's why this election is so important. I've said this before. New York is a dark horse state. You know, we got to watch New York. We got to watch California because it is the path that pro-abortion Democrats are going to use to maintain control of the Senate and take control of the House of Representatives.
By the way, insurers, and this is where it gets interesting, are prohibited from limiting or excluding coverage for abortions that are medically necessary. Now, Reverend Hardin, I know that most people would buzz right past that phrase, medically necessary. Is an abortion ever medically necessary?
No. In fact, there's just an OBGYN that just came out recently saying there's never a time when abortion is medically necessary. Now, you might get an arrogant doctor who says, or a lazy doctor who says, I just don't want to deal with the complexity of this woman's condition, and they might recommend an abortion, but there is never a medically necessary abortion. You know, look, the reality is abortion is not medicine. Abortion is the original quackery, as you mentioned. Like if you were to take the Hippocratic Oath, you know, 40,
first,
50 years
no
ago.
Do no harm. Yep.
Do no harm. Yeah. There's also another phrase in there that says, I will not give a woman an abortive remedy, which is why would, of all the quote medical practices they would put in the Hippocratic Oath, why put abortion in there? And it's because it's the opposite of medicine. Medicine is designed to heal and to maintain the health of the patient, not to kill. And so what abortion does is exactly the opposite for both women and for, obviously, for the preborn boy or girl. But look, we filed a front of the court brief in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is about to hear a case with the Albany Diocese in New York because they've been pushing back on New York State saying, hey, look, you can't force Christians who are pro-life to fund abortion, which is what you're doing through their health insurance plans. And we're like, this is pro-abortion bigotry. They're claiming these candidates and Harris included are claiming that we're going to rob women of their reproductive rights. In fact, the pro-abortion politicians in charge of the Democrat Party have been robbing pro-life people of their freedoms and their dignity for the last 50 years. They're throwing pro-life people, peaceful pro-life people, in federal prison. grandmothers and stay-at-home moms simply because they insist on voicing their belief that all people are made in the image of God and deserving of blessing and protection from the womb to the tomb.
I mean, if they want to do it this way, I'll tell you what, Reverend Hardin, why didn't the state of New York just say when you opt into your health insurance coverage, whether it's through your employer or some other way, say, I support abortion or I don't. If you support it, you get to pay a piece of the cost. If you don't support it, then you don't have to fund that. They could do that fairly easily, couldn't they? I mean, right now is the so-called open enrollment time for most companies where they say, do you want to change any of your health care coverages? I would simply say, I don't choose to pay for other people's abortions. If they want to have them, let other people pay for it and then split the cost among the maybe 40% of Americans who are enthusiastic about abortion. I'm not one of them.
Well, that would make sense. But we're not talking about people who are interested in, you know, reasonable solutions. We're talking about essentially secular fundamentalists who have no tolerance for people who differ with their ideology. They don't want anyone to publicly disagree with them or enhance policies that would differ with their, extremism.
Yeah. So what do we do at this point? They also say that employers, even religious employers, have to extend coverage to employees at no cost to the employee that covers abortion. That means you're going to have the Catholic Archdiocese. I happen to be Protestant, but I just picked it because you can point to an organization. You're going to take the Catholic Archdiocese of New York, and you're going to say you will provide abortion coverage for everybody who works for you.
That's exactly what they're doing. In fact, I sat down with a priest and I said, hey, look, your Catholic insurance is mandated by New York to cover abortion and abortion-causing contraception. And he said, no, it's not. I said, sure it is. Go look at it. And so he went upstairs, came back down with his policy, and he said, I can't believe what I'm reading. I can't believe it. I'm like, well, believe it. That's what's happening right now. And by the way, if New York politicians like Hakeem Jeffries get control of the House and Chuck Schumer maintains control, look, this kind of stuff, wherever pro-abortion politicians are, they make this kind of stuff normative. And that's what we've been dealing with in New York, and we have to keep pushing back. It harms us in terms of our ability to hire quality people and to maintain quality people as staff at Compass Care. We're an ecumenical organization. We're not part of the Catholic diocese or anything, but we support them in their fight against New York because, look, this has implications for all of us.
Yep, it certainly does. Reverend Hardin, thanks very much. That's Jim Hardin, CEO of Compass Care Pregnancy Services. Let me go to Declan in Missouri. Hey, Declan, we're close to the break, but what's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to denounce the horrible rhetoric coming from the Republicans calling Trump a Nazi. John Kelly, Mark Esper, General Mattis, J.D. Vance, Bill Barr, Rex Tillerson, Mike Pence. Why does the GOP keep calling Trump a Nazi? That's horrible.
I don't think it's the GOP. I think the Democrats, for the most part, I certainly don't think J.D. Vance
is called. Those are all Republicans I've just listed off.
Well, I understand they have that label on their name, but you're saying J.D. Vance, the running mate of Donald Trump, has called him a Nazi? When did he do that?
He called him America's Nazi back before Trump was in office.
Yeah, changed his mind. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Getting quality.
Want to listen to an interview again? Check out LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And we always begin by inviting you to be part of the conversation. If you want to take part in what we call honestly provocative talk radio, the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day. And you're welcome to join in at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Let's go to your calls. It is a First Amendment Friday, after all. I want to see what James has to say, because James is a naysayer. And as you know, on this show, every naysayer goes right to the head of the line. James, welcome to the program. And what do you and I disagree about?
Hi, Lars. How's it going?
It's going very well. Thanks.
99% of the time, and I don't know if I necessarily disagree, but so, you know, the other day you were talking about the comparison between specifically like union electricians and non-union electricians. And I happen to be, I've been an electrician since I graduated high school in 08. And up until about, I live in Washington, and up until about 3 years ago, I worked for the private sector and then organized into my local union. And when you're talking about the quality of electricians, in 2008 up until 2023, and even prior to 2008, if you were not in the union, you were considered a trainee. You were a trainee, not an apprentice. So
okay. So a difference in wording, but really the same thing, right?
Well, it is, but it has to do with the amount of schooling. So, prior to 2023, to become a O-1 journeyman electrician, where you can do commercial work, residential, like anything other than power lines, you only needed 96 hours of classroom time, and then the same amount of on the job hours, which was 8,000. But what I've come to realize in my experience, and I've been a journeyman electrician, I'm a lead foreman for a big union company. But yeah, what I've noticed, the difference between me and some of the union guys, and you get what you put into it, right? But the schooling, like the electrical theory and why things work a certain way, like why motors spin a certain way, how to troubleshoot the
right.
And I'm not a pro union guy.
Okay, but we're getting a little far afield, and I just worry about that because, you know, I have to watch the clock too. But James, what happened was, I was saying, look, I don't think much of unions. I don't want to be in one. I've been forced a couple of times to be in one. I got out or decertified that union as fast as I possibly could, because I don't like the extortionist tactics they use. And I don't like the fact that most union members don't seem to realize that about 80% of the money they pay to the union does not go to represent them. It goes to Democrats, who most of the people who are in the trades don't vote for Democrats. They vote for conservatives. But this gentleman called in and he said, Lars, you don't understand. Union electricians are trained better than private sector. And I said, I don't believe that's true, because the apprenticeship programs for both in at least the last decade have been the same. They require the same amount of classroom training, same amount of OJT, on-the-job training,
standards. It's not the same around. It's not the same amount of hours. They changed that. That's what I was saying. When I got my license, I only needed 96
hours. That was then. But having recently investigated it.
That was up until 2023.
When I looked into it for my stepson, I said there's this state program and it requires four years of training.
Which
is 800 hours, 8,000 hours OJT. And then I looked at the union one and it was the same numbers.
That's what I'm saying. But up until 2023, you only needed 96 hours of continuing education, is what it's called. When you have an apprentice trainee card, you every 2 years, when you have to renew it, 2 or 3 years, you only need X amount of hours, of which I think was...
Okay, so hours, but James, does that necessarily make a better trained electrician?
Absolutely. Because when you know electrical theory, you can troubleshoot way better by doing simple things, by trying to figure out which cord.
And you're telling me that the private sector doesn't teach that?
No, not they. You will, based on it's all based on who your journeyman or who is in charge of you. So some people are better than others. So
right.
In the private
sector, means you're aren't you likely to get some people from the private sector who are actually better than the union guy and vice versa?
Potentially, yes. Yes.
And that's why when the gentleman called me and said, you don't understand, all union electricians are better than all private sector, I said, that doesn't make any sense because there are plenty of people.
It's not across the board.
That's right. And should the private sector be able to make its own mind up? And an employer could say, I want to hire that person. He knows his stuff. And then bring him on the job. And 3 months or 6 months in, you say, this guy really knows his stuff. He hasn't had any major problems at all. And he's not union, or he is union. Either way. But when the union says, we want to demand more money, and we will do it by extorting it from employers by saying, if you don't pay more money, we'll shut down your job site. And we'll keep all the other trade unions off as a way of extorting more money. Does that sound legitimate to you?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, so when I organized in at the beginning of our contract, but we weren't extorted of any money. We have a no strike clause in our union, so we can't even go out and strike.
Well, then what good does the union do you?
Well, I agree. I don't know why people before me voted on that, but we
and,
got.
And by the way, James, what do you think about the fact that 80 cents out of every dollar you pay to your union is going to people I'm willing to bet you don't vote for?
Oh, I absolutely hate it, Lars. I strictly got into it for the money. Like, I got two kids and a wife. I'm like, what, I'm running work for a private sector job for a friends of mine, but it just the money, you know, and they weren't a big shop either, but you know, it was for me strictly it was for the money and the benefits. Like that was something I've had to look past. I don't agree with it at all.
And that's one of the reasons why today about 6% of Americans in the private sector are represented by unions, and the other 94% say I'm not going to have anything to do with them, and I'm especially not going to pay union dues. You got the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Getting quality employees.
I mean, it's First Amendment Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, a couple of years ago, I would have admitted to you, I had never heard of Trendy Aragua, if I'm saying that the right way, but that is the Venezuelan gang that is now literally taking over apartment buildings and, in some cases, arguably, certain cities in America, and who knows where they're going to go with that. So I thought we'd get Sergeant Betsy Bratner-Smith on, spokesperson for the National Police Association, about what this Venezuelan gang doing and how it's become one of America's biggest crime threats. Sergeant Smith, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's great to be with you. And Trendy Aragua is a problem. It's basically MS-13. Remember, we were talking about them a few years ago.
Yep.
It's MS-13 on steroids. This is a criminal gang, a transnational criminal gang that is known for trafficking in drugs and guns and women and children. They shot, you know, some of their members shot a couple of NYPD officers a few months ago. They murdered a retired Venezuelan police officer in South Florida. They preyed on a all-female staff of a jewelry store in Colorado and robbed that store and beat the women. And now they've taken over a hotel in El Paso, Texas. And I could go on and on and on. These are vicious people, and they get into this country by taking advantage of our poorest borders. They share identification and paperwork among their members, and they all get in here. They're living off our system while they are victimizing our citizens and their own fellow illegal aliens.
So tell me this, Betsy, is this one of those problems where America really doesn't know, since we've never confronted something precisely like this? I mean, the police and the prosecutors have confronted organized criminal activity, the mafia, the, you know, the Crips and Bloods gangs, all these other gangs. But this is a whole new problem, or is it the same old problem? And how do you deal with
it? Well, I would call it an additional problem. We already have 32,000 different identified street gangs in this country. And what are we doing now? We're importing more. You know, law enforcement in this nation is short-staffed. We're dealing with the same criminal gangs we've been dealing with for the last, you know, 40 years that I've been involved in law enforcement. And now we're bringing in one of the most vicious criminal gangs in the world. And that is Tren de Aragua, means the train from Aragua in Venezuela. They famously took over a prison in their own country and put in a bar, a disco, and a pool,
and
basically ran
and
it.
And
yes, and they ran it. And so now that that nation has failed, thanks to Marxism, I hope everyone understands that, they're coming to the United States again. We don't need to import more criminals. We have plenty of our own, and this is just burdening an already overburdened criminal justice system.
Now, I got to ask you this, because I don't take the Biden administration, well, I do take them seriously, but I don't take their efforts or their claimed efforts seriously. But Biden would have you believe, oh, no, we're going to take the people who've been committing crimes here and deport them. Can't we take all of these people who are part of Tren de Aragua and simply say, you're not here legally, we're sending you home, you know, where we pick them up and ship them out? That sound now to a civilian who's never been a cop, that sounds like the logical way to deal with them, you know, unless they've already committed a serious crime here, like rape or murder, just take them and ship them home. But can we do that with Tren de Aragua?
Well, we can, but that has to be up to the federal government, and they won't. And that is the problem that we have here. We also have to understand that many of these gang members, we have not been able to identify. They have gotten in as one of the thousands and thousands of gotaways. And like I said, they are sharing identification, both real and false. And, you know, because usually the Border Patrol is able to, when they stop these people, they're able to get a handle on who they are pretty quickly, and they're able to send them back. But if you can't identify them and you don't have a Department of Justice, I'm talking to you, Merrick Garland, who has the political will to send these people back, we are stuck with them. And it's law enforcement and our citizens who are stuck having to deal with these
criminals. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, but when we talk about sending people back, I recall a few years ago, we wanted to send a bunch of criminals back to China, and China just said, we're not taking them. Is Venezuela taking these folks back when we say, these people are here, they're criminals, we don't want them, we're sending them back to you? Can we send them back?
We can send them back to a point, but you're right. Venezuela doesn't have to allow our planes to land. They don't have to allow it. The bigger problem is our government doesn't want to do it. Our government doesn't want to deport these individuals simply for being here illegally. And don't forget, many of our big blue city mayors have gotten rid of their gang databases, things like that, saying they are racist. So the DAC is really stacked against law enforcement. And this is at a time when we're being told that crime is down and this and that. That's absolutely not true. It was famously fact-checked on the debate stage the other night, when in reality, crime continues to be on the rise, but the reporting of crime is going down, both to the FBI and
by the
local
way,
law enforcement.
Betsy, let me ask you this, because I watched the whole debate and then rewatched it, and you know, I thought it was pathetic. David Muir knows better. Maybe Lindsay Davis is a nitwit and a sorority sister, but David Muir knows better. When he was insisting, well, crime is down. Do they understand what you and I have talked about? This almost everybody who's talked about the subject has talked about the fact that after the pandemic and after the, you know, George Floyd nonsense and the defunding of police, a whole bunch of big city departments just stopped reporting, if not all of their crime, then much of their crime. And it made the numbers artificially seem to go down. But everybody in law enforcement understand they didn't. Are we really led to believe that ABC News does not understand that crime is up, but reporting of crime is down?
Remember what David Muir said. According to the FBI, crime is down. Technically, he's not wrong on that, because local and state law enforcement are supposed to report their crime stats to the FBI, and only about 40% or so of agencies are doing that. So David Muir was technically right, because he couched it with the FBI says. But, you know, if he wants to torpedo his journalism career, I guess that's his choice.
Absolutely right. That's Sergeant Betsy Bratner-Smith with the National Police Association. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Are the greatest jokes.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now,
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
I mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk radio.
It's never too early to learn that the government is a greedy piglet that suckles on a taxpayer's teat until they have sore, chapped nipples.
Lars.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Now, here's your host.
Wait a minute. I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and a real pleasure to welcome back John Solomon. John, I know that just the news is your thing, but I practically feel like you're part of the Trump team. So congratulations on the win Tuesday night.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, listen, it's good for the country. The country made a decision. They got what they wanted, and now the country can move forward. And I think that's very important to this country, to get on track. We suffered through 4 years of inflation and insecurity and sometimes insanity. And Americans believe that by choosing Donald Trump, they've chosen to stop that, all three of those crises, and get back to life as normal. And also, I would say, to common sense.
By the way, can you say, I don't know how well you know, I don't know her at all, but Susie Summerall Wiles. Do you know the new first?
I do know her very
chief?
Well. She is an extraordinarily great choice for chief, because she is calm. She is cerebral. She is policy smart, and she understands President Trump the way few people do. And so they work wonderfully together. And I think this is going to be a powerhouse team of the president and this chief. I think they're going to do great things together, and there'll be a lot more order and organization in the House. You know, the Trump campaign was incredibly organized, incredibly disciplined with messaging and behavior. And I think that will carry into the White House, and that is going to be good for Trump 47 White House.
Does that contrast with the Kamala Harris campaign?
It does. It might contrast a little bit with the first Trump administration, which sometimes was a little chaotic and sometimes had a few freelancers. If you notice, there were just no freelancing in the Trump campaign.
A few?
Yes, I was trying to be diplomatic. Quite a few is maybe the right word. This crowd, this Trump campaign was disciplined for 2 years. There weren't leaks. There weren't off-scripted messages, and I think the American people appreciated that. They understood what President Trump stood for every day, and there was no mixed messaging. That will now continue into the White House if Susie Wiles is in charge.
Well, and by the way, John, there's one that sticks in my head, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but there was a point in the early part of Trump's first term where he had talked to the president of Mexico, and within, I think, hours, it might have been a little, but hours, it was already leaked out, and I thought, how does a private presidential phone call to the president of another country become public? And then during Biden, you only heard leaks if it benefited the Biden administration.
Yeah, I bet you this chief of staff will keep the call, the number of people who have access to a call, extremely limited. I think that will be very important, given the leaks that the State Department and intelligence community did in the first administration. Listen, it's not a secret. I don't think anyone would tell you that it's a secret that the State Department and much of the intelligence community is now governed and embedded with lots of liberal people whose politics sometimes leads before their policy or intelligence responsibilities. You saw that with the Ukraine impeachment leak, with the leak of the Zelensky conversation, which, by the way, wasn't even an accurate leak the first time. That didn't matter. They just wanted to smear the president. I think they'll tighten up access. I think they'll tighten up discipline. It'll be harder for the enemies of the president inside the government to leak or get access to things that they can try to damage him with.
Okay, so tell me, I'm talking to John Solomon. He's the founder of JustTheNews.com. I go to Just the News every multiple times every day to look for the latest breaking stories he's got because he has the leading edge on those things. Do you make the case that the Democrats effectively pushed voters right into Donald Trump's waiting arms?
Yeah, listen, I think Donald Trump pushed them into their arms because he had policies that aligned with their needs. And I think Kamala Harris was given an opportunity to be embraced by America, but instead she rejected their embrace. She refused to tell them what she stood for because what she stood for wasn't aligned with their values. So she wanted to keep it a secret and see if she could get away with it. And I watched some really shameful displays of Democrats trying to suggest that the electorate was racist or mean or hatred. It's not. It's Americans. It's white Americans, black Americans, Hispanic Americans, young Americans, old Americans, Americans of all ages and all persuasions. They all voted for Donald Trump because he offered them clear policy solutions. And I think the first credit goes to President Trump for leading with substance. Remember, he used to do those 5-minute videos at the beginning of the campaign. Yep. There wasn't a policy issue, an idea that Americans didn't get first from him. And when they did the tax on tips, Kamala Harris had to copy it just to stay even with them. I think he led with policy and he won with that. Now, that said, Kamala Harris was a very weak candidate. She was she didn't have much substance. She didn't offer much substance. She giggled and she had awkward moments. She had word salads. And quite frankly, she talked to a very small, narrow part of one percenters and elitists in America, and not to the masses who were willing to give her the time and understanding. Say, hey, tell us what you stand for. She just didn't answer their concerns.
One of my big disappointments, John, was that Paul Ryan, I think, sold out. As House Speaker, he had the ability to push the Trump agenda. He did not. Now, I don't know if you agree with me on that. It doesn't matter. What I want to know is this time around, do we have Republicans in both the House and the Senate? I guess we're going to have 53 votes in the Senate. Some of the House races are still hanging. But can we actually get some things done and have Congress move at more than its usual glacial pace?
Yeah, that's the $7 trillion question because that's how much we're spending a year now. That's insane. We were just spending $4.9 trillion just 4 years ago. We've added that much spending every year, and we've created chaos globally and in our own country, and we've indebted our country shamefully. We'll have to wait and see whether there is the ability of a speaker and of a Senate leader, and I think that who those people are will have some say in it. I think another thing will be how closely President Trump House Speaker Mike Johnson, if he's going to be the speaker, and whoever the Senate leader is, how closely they speak together, how closely they stick together, and how closely they can force Republicans to take the votes they need to get progress down the field. The last couple of years, the Republicans seemed like a debate club. I mean, they had no discipline, and there were 220 opinions, and they didn't care what the caucus actually did. Donald Trump doesn't tolerate that, doesn't stand for that. He won't suffer it well. And I think he'll pick a speaker and a strategy that enforces discipline. And I think one of the mistakes, and a lot of members have said this to me, the Republicans are worried about their reelection chances before they got their job done. And I think they put their reelection chances in danger by not getting much done. this Congress, I think they will worry about getting their job done, and they'll figure out after the hard votes how to protect those people from their election troubles after that. They were going to reverse engineer the process in Republican caucus.
Now, John, I was a kid when this happened, but Johnson, President Johnson, used to literally put his arm around somebody from the other side and say, you're going to get this done, aren't you, on live TV. Is it impolitic for Donald Trump to walk over to the House or the Senate while the TV cameras are there and say, hey, Senator so-and-so, you're going to get my bill out there and get it for a hearing, aren't you? Is it too far outside the range to ask?
There's nothing outside that Donald Trump won't try. He is a clear communicator, and I think that's why people picked him, right? He doesn't, you know what he says what he means, and he means what he says. And I think, what happened for Republicans from the 2017 time period forward until present is they've governed from fear. They're always fearful of what the Democrats and the American people. Donald Trump governs from a source of strength. We're going to do this, and then we'll figure a way to overcome all the things that happen. And if a man can survive 4 indictments, 2 impeachments, 2 assassination attempts, and $1 billion of lawfare, I think he's going to get some significant people following him saying, that guy survived it. I could take a couple hits myself.
Absolutely. John Solomon from JustTheNews.com.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Provocative talk radio. Here's Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and always glad to welcome back Ryan Walters, who is the state superintendent of public education for Oklahoma State School District, former U.S. history teacher. Ryan, I'm a little off balance after the call I just took. It's getting crazy out there as we head up to the last 30 hours or so before we get a decision in the election. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me on the eve of what can be a monumental day tomorrow and getting the country back on track.
Wouldn't it be great? And in fact, I think you and I have talked about this. Getting rid of the Department of Ed would be a fantastic, boon to education throughout America, because then it would be up to the people of Oklahoma to determine how much money they want to spend and how they want that education K-12 delivered.
Well, and that's something that, the left has so captured education and done it through the Federal Department of Education and all these national groups like the National Teachers Union that partner with the Federal Department of Education. I'm telling you, I think people would be shocked to see the difference doing away with that department would make across the country, because for one, it is going to make it so much more difficult for your local teachers unions to exert the same power. I mean, we've had millions of dollars dumped into our state from the federal teachers union, and the Federal Department of Education threatens us all the time to either push indoctrination, push their ideology, or bust here. And that's what we continue to see with everything they're doing. They have a left-wing agenda, and we've got to fight it.
Have you managed to peel back all the DEI that Oklahoma schools had when you arrived, if there was any?
Yeah, look, I mean, what we saw were DEI programs, social emotional learning programs, all of this transgenderism that, we started asking questions, and it's like, we got this grant from the feds, or hey, the feds said there's this or that, and then we get these letters from Joe Biden that, told us he'd sue us as an agency, as individual districts, and as individuals if we don't recognize transgenderism as his new definition of boys and girls. And so, it was not only the dollars, it was, legal threats of, we could come after you for violating these as a civil rights violation. The absurdity, you got to remember, most districts are going, we can't fight the Federal Department of Education and all the resources at their disposal. So we even have districts out in Oklahoma that were doing it, and we go, guys, no. No one in Oklahoma is doing it. If they threaten you directly, you come tell us, and we're going to stand in the way. And so you've seen that weaponized in such a tremendous way, just like you've seen the Justice Department going after President Trump. They've turned the Department of Education into an agency to go after parents and kids.
Well, Ryan, one of the reasons I brought up DEI in particular, because I think it's just plain out-and-out racism to teach kids that if you have black or brown skin, that you're automatically a victim, you're automatically not capable of doing work, whether it's math work or science work or anything else. and then tell the, you know, the kids that if you've got white skin, that you're part of this oppressor class that exists. I mean, so it's toxic in education. The problem is there isn't a great way of measuring or showing the damage. But just last week, Boeing Corporation, right? Boeing makes spacecraft, they make missiles and defense systems, and they make passenger aircraft. And what's happened in the last 5 years or so? Their spacecraft, strands a couple of astronauts. Their airplanes have parts falling off literally mid-air. And they've had airplanes like the 737 MAX that had massive failures that actually killed people. And what did Boeing do last week? They ditched their entire DEI effort. Why? Because it's better to hire people who know how to make airplanes, no matter what skin color they are, no matter what gender they are, no matter what pronoun they go by. This is an American company that says, we did that DEI thing for a while. We've been producing failures lately. We're getting rid of the whole mess. The problem is, I don't have any way, and I don't even know that you have a way of measuring how much damage it does to kids when you convince them that somehow their skin color defines who they are. But the damage is there all the same. It's just a lot easier to spot the damage when the company makes airplanes and spacecraft.
That's exactly right. It's really immeasurable because you just start thinking about how much of a kid's potential you're literally, you know, stopping immediately when a, you know, a kid's told that they can't do something because of the color of their skin. There's a lot of them that go, I mean, look, these are adults telling me this, so, you know, they're probably right. I mean, I guess, you know, I'm only 10, you know, what, how am I supposed to, you know, navigate this? I'll tell you, the first public meeting I had, we had computer science standards, Lars, that we were trying to connect to, you know, a lot of our industry. We have a big aerospace industry in Oklahoma, and so we're trying to connect computer science standards to that. And the team previous to me was run by a Democrat. They have all this DEI stuff in there. They want to talk to kids about, I mean, literally, it was diversity, equity, inclusion by name. They were in there talking about, hey, look, we need kids to understand how whiteness affects their view of computer science, the difference between the races. And I'm going, what are you guys talking about? You know, you were the ones who were saying you want more kids involved in computer science, and you're going to start off by telling them that whiteness controls computer. It's like, this is absurd. How about this? Our computer science standards will just have things about computer science, nothing about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and the left lost their mind. My first board meeting, and I go, guys, this isn't a hard one for most people to understand. When we say math, we mean math. When we say computer science, we mean computer science. Your garbage is going to have to go somewhere else, but they embed it in every part of education that if you're not going in and seeking it out, they slip it in all over the place.
Well, and see, that's what I'm worried about, because if you get some kid who says, hey, it doesn't matter if 2 + 2 = 4 or 5 or 6, then, you know, because of this, the color of my skin, and anybody who insists that it 2 + 2 = 4, that must be because of their white dominance and colonialism and 50 other, you know, horrible things, according to the left, then you're going to produce somebody who can't do the job. And what matters is doing the job, isn't it?
And that's exactly right. And you get to a place where, you know, like you said, you know, Elon Musk has done a great job of talking about it when it comes to surgeons or pilots, things like that. It's like, guys, you know, there's real life consequences for creating a system that's so backwards, so, you know, attacks any kind of merit-based system that you go, guys, like, it's amazing to me, Lars, that, hey, you know, we like our sports down here. We're big football fans in Oklahoma. Yep. It's like, hey, we don't do that in football. It's like, hey, I want the best quarterback behind the center. I want the best running back on the field because you know what? Hey, we want to win. You know, it's like this. Okay, you don't want the best pilot in the plane? You don't want the best surgeon operating on you? Well, I do.
You mean you haven't seen a single coach that says, my front line is too white, or my, you know, I don't have sufficient number of people of color or whatever in this position or that position? They just take the kids and go out and run them. Say, you're a really good runner, you're going to be a running back. You're really big, we're going to put you on the front line. We don't care what color you are. Stop the opposing team from getting to the quarterback or the ball.
That's right. I mean, that's where, you know, you see it in sports. They would be laughed out of the building if they walked in and said, nope, we need this color of person here and this color of person. No. They'd be like, hey, who's the best at it? And again, there's a reason why we've always seen these premier athletes. And by the way, don't you love their stories, Lars? You got some people come from, you know, absolute poverty, people that overcome drug addiction. You have every background. It's beautiful to listen to the stories in sports. And you go, okay, why aren't we doing the same thing intellectually? That's one of my problems with education. I'm a former coach and teacher. And I was like, guys, I'm going to expect the same thing in a classroom. Everybody from no matter where you come from, you can be successful. And I'm going to push you for it, just like I do on the basketball court, just like I do on the baseball field, football field. The same lessons apply, but the left has just so controlled academia that they just check common sense at the door.
I'm talking to Ryan Walters, who's the Oklahoma State Schools Superintendent and a former U.S. history teacher. So let me take you to the dark side of this, and that is, What if Kamala Harris ekes out a win tomorrow? What will that mean for education, not just in Oklahoma, but around the country?
Well, just to be clear, I think Donald Trump's going to win. I think he's mobilized everyone.
So do I.
But if you want to walk me down that scenario, and again, boy, Lars, I've taken me a dark place tonight. But look, I think it's going to be devastating. I think you're going to see it full scale. I think she's worse than Joe Biden. I think Joe Biden was absolutely terrible, absolutely liberal. But I think Kamala Harris is just absolutely a Marxist to her core. She believes in this stuff in a way that I don't even know if Joe Biden did. And I think you're going to see an extremely aggressive Federal Department of Education. And frankly, you know, look, we've planned for everything here. And I'm going to tell you, states are going to have to be so aggressive to fight back on what the feds are going to do. I mean, you're going to see transgenderism pushed to the fullest tilt because they believe in remaking society. And that comes with breaking down the family, breaking down norms. And that transgenderism movement is the most aggressive in the country. They back it 100% in the Democrat Party. You will see it in a school near you if they have their way. And by the way, it won't be optional. They are going to push it, and they are going to use every threat, every ounce of power they have to push it onto your kids.
Absolutely. Ryan, thank you very much. That's Ryan Walters, Oklahoma State School Superintendent.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. With authors, experts, and a healthy dose of opinion. Find it at LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails. I want to talk about the threat America faces from Chinese hackers and whether or not it's even worse than you ever would have thought before. And to do that, I brought on Keith Hansen, who's a veteran law enforcement expert, also the CEO currently of QUX Technologies. Keith, welcome back to the program.
Welcome. You say currently. Do you know something I don't know?
Well, I guess I would, I'll tell you this, Keith. I was going to share with you, I've shared it with my audience before. TikTok is not on any of my devices. It is not on any of Tina, my wife's devices. It is not in our home, and I won't have it in our home, even though the other social media, I'm sure, are gathering data. TikTok is gathering data on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party. And I also point out to people that the TikTok you see in America, number one, is not allowed to be on social media in China. They do not let their own population see what is on TikTok. TikTok China is more like just DIY stuff and, you know, messages from the Politburo in Beijing and garbage like that. But the one they put in America is something special and for a reason. Am I right to suspect that?
Yep. You are correct. And more to the point, just because, I mean, TikTok is in and of itself, it's Chinese technology developed by the Chinese. That doesn't mean that before I get into this, we have to look at it from the standpoint of when you sign up for any social media service or platform or anything, when you agree to terms of service, you agree to the participation of third party entities within your activity. And they say that we may sell or market your data to third-party entities. That includes data analytics firms, AI firms, things like that. So it is not unreasonable nor unexpected that one or more of those third parties that is purchasing your aggregated data isn't a Chinese firm. In fact, more to the point, it would make sense that a company that is involved in data analytics, for instance, would actually be owned by the Chinese or would be owned by a shell company that China has a controlling interest in because they want that information. So it's not uncommon to find companies that are, that their beneficial ownership is Chinese or that main players within that company are either openly Chinese or that may be feeding information to the CCP because they have access to that information. So the bottom line is China's getting your information, whether it's as blatant as the TikTok application or as covert as a third-party data analytics firm purchasing that information from Instagram or Facebook or anything else like that and then feeding that information to the Chinese. They're getting your information, whether you know it or you don't.
Okay.
So people, you know, and I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, what do we do about this? And how much do we have to fear that the Chinese government is not getting this data? I understand why some of the social media in America do this. I start looking at power tools, and pretty soon, every time I look at X or Instagram, there are ads for power tools. Okay, they're trying to sell me what I'm interested in anyway. That's kind of a benign use because it also means unless Tina uses one of my devices, I don't see ads for yoga pants or other girly stuff. I see the stuff I want to see, unless I loan her my iPad, in which case it comes back with all these ads that I don't have any interest in. That's almost a beneficial kind of use of data. But what are the Chinese communists planning to do with all that data?
Well, any number of things. What are you transmitting, you know, through your devices? Is there malware that's being put on your devices? Are there keystroke loggers that are being put on your devices? Is there something that can read your screen that's being put on your device? And then if I wanted to hack into your information, let's say, for instance, that you worked for a company that had intellectual property or had state secrets, and I wanted to be able to access your devices so I could access the information that you were in steady contact with through your workplace, then I could very easily launch a social engineering campaign against you using information that I know about you to pretend to be a person that you have contact with or do business with or a company that you do business with in an attempt to get you to log into a system to steal credentials. And then using those credentials, I could now access different portals that are either workplace portals for you or social media portals for you to be able to get into your network, to be able to get into the websites that you put information onto if I wanted to steal those secrets.
Is there any way to combat that?
How do you combat it? Remember when 60 Minutes was talking to Morgan Freeman about racism?
Yep.
And Mike Wallace says, well, how do we get rid of it? Morgan Freeman says, well, stop talking about it. Well, how do we deal with this issue? Get off of social media. What does social media do for you besides feed you a steady addiction of what it is that you're addicted to? Social media, I got off of social media years ago, Lars, and I got to be honest with you, I'm a much happier person for it. I'm a better person for it. Make the commitment. You know what? We got January 1st coming up here in a few short weeks. Make it your New Year's resolution to get off of Facebook and get off of Instagram and get off of all of these social media and get out and actually live. But stop being tied to these. You know, my fiance and I were scoping out wedding locations, wedding venues this past weekend. We walk into this very nice restaurant and we're watching this family of five. No conversation whatsoever. Everybody's sitting there, mom, dad, and the three kids, and they're all sitting there with their busy boxes, and they're all playing on their phones. Hey, I got a crazy idea. People talking about the breakdown of the American family. Put down the damn phone and have a conversation with your spouse. Ask your kids how their day at school was. Get off of social media. We want to fix this problem. You know, it's a self-correcting problem, but it's a self-fueling issue.
I got to tell you something, Keith. I use social media for work. I don't use it much for my – and I like to put my device down and not do anything, not have any – if there are other things to do. And I've always got something else to do. If my granddaughter is singing, I don't even look at the phone. But I will tell you that for my work, it is nice because – I can go on there, and if and I will tell you, there are literally hundreds of characters, both in government and outside of government, who are saying things. And I wish I could tell you that I'm so omniscient that I'm aware of everything being said by every Democrat and every Republican and every office holder in the country. I'm not. But when I look at social media, most of the things I follow, almost all of them, are things that say, hey, look what Senator Rubio said now that he's been picked as Secretary or appears to be picked as Secretary of State. I look at that and I say, okay, that's an interesting soundbite. I'm going to want to pursue that. And that's what I use it for. I use it for prospecting, for stories and that sort of thing for the most part.
You know, I get that because having been in the business of broadcast radio since 2008, I get it. I know what it's like. I gave up Facebook until I came up to New Hampshire to do my morning drive show. And then, you know, the general manager of the station, I was broadcasting on five radio stations. So the manager of the family of radio stations said, hey, you know, you gotta do a social media platform. We need this for you. So what did I do? I mean, I now established a personality page so that way there I could put out the things that I needed to put out. But by and large, I restricted that to work only.
And I'm not doing any Facebook at all, and almost 100% of what I put on social media. I'm not taking pictures of my lunch, by the way, folks. It's all about the business. That's Keith Hansen, who's CEO of QUX Technologies. Keith, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Your source for real red meat radio, the Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on the day after an historic election that made me so gratified last night to see Donald Trump win the Electoral College and win the popular vote. And the left didn't know what to do with itself. MSNBC, well, you would have thought that you were seeing video of a funeral somewhere when you watch their news anchors try to react to what happened to them last night. It kind of reminded me of 2016, but it was more dramatic this time. I thought we'd talk with Ryan Walker, who's executive vice president for the group Heritage Action, about what Donald Trump's first and first.
Correct. So this year is a lot different than past years for Donald Trump. The transition team is more professional. It's more organized. It's more dedicated to the task in front of it. They have landing teams for various agencies across the federal government. They have presumably, I would imagine that they have ideas of what those people will do in the first 100 days of getting into those agencies. And then we'll have to contend in Congress with government funding and the ability of the administration to continue acting on things like the border and the crime rates in America and some of these issues that have come up on the campaign trail. So there will be a lot of activity very early on in the administration.
Okay, so Ryan, how much of this can happen very quickly? I mean, because, for example, one of the things I've talked about, and feel free to correct me on this, but one of the things that Biden did was he took virtually everything Trump had done under existing law, laws already on the books, and he said, we're going to do these things to control the border. You know, remain in Mexico was one of the policies. There were other things that were subject to executive orders by Joe Biden and by extension Kamala Harris that effectively reversed all of that. How quickly can that damage that was done by Biden and Harris be undone and be put back in place to start taking control of that border?
Yeah, it's a great question. So first and foremost, all of the executive orders will be reinstalled day one. Remain in Mexico will need some negotiation with foreign nations, Mexico in particular, to make sure that we can continue to have that sort of operating agreement. But I do not doubt President Trump's ability to negotiate something like that.
You think?
But he'll reinstitute all of that immediately. Mark Morgan and Tom Homan, some of the best border security professionals in the country will be leading that operation for him. So it will be fast and very quickly. The thing that Heritage Action has been thinking about and considering is if Congress needs to front load funding, importantly, for Department of Homeland Security here in December when government funding is up, so that the Trump administration has a bit of money to move around to do things like continue to build the border wall or implement more ICE agents or more CBP officers. Those are the things that we're thinking about going into January.
And by the way, do you get any help out of this fact? Because we don't know where the House is going to sit right now, whether it'll be a really skinny margin. We know that there will be control of the Senate. But is it possible in those negotiations to say, look, we need this money? You've already got Kamala Harris on record, you know, who said that she was she was willing to back a bill that had more border wall in it. It had a bunch of other nonsense in it, too. But can you get some action there if the margin happens to be a bit skinny so that the current House of Representatives can act on that and have it ready to go? And if not, you know, is it possible to start using the bully pulpit to say, well, we're going to hit the ground running, but we've already got the Democrats in Congress acting to obstruct everything we're trying to do, including policies that Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have said that they are willing to back.
Yeah, I have high confidence that the House will be retained by the Republican majority. And those members, a lot of them, especially the new members, and there will be some of them, not as many as in past election cycles, but certainly quite a few. All of those members, and I mean every single one of them, have ridden the coattails of Donald Trump, or at least the messaging components and the policy points and positions that he is advocating for on the campaign trail. They are committed MAGA Republicans. They are committed America First Republicans. And I think these folks will get into Congress, one, with a lot of energy, and they'll be willing to convince their fellow colleagues, maybe some of these members that have been around for some time, that this is the pathway forward. And Donald Trump said it himself. This is a new movement for the Republican Party. This is a new coalition of voters that the Republican Party hasn't seen, maybe in its history. And members are going to have to adjust their thinking going into this next Congress. He will have 18 months to accomplish anything. So they're going to have to hit the ground running day one.
Okay, so tell me this. And people have been, and this may be too small a detail. Can they restart the Keystone XL pipeline or at least communicate to the private companies that were building it before Joe unceremoniously shut it down? Can we say, hey, day one, we can't mess with foreign policy because of the Logan Act till he hits the office. But could he reach out to those companies and say, you want to get that project started again? We can make that happen. Can that happen? Can that start happening now and even before he officially takes office?
Yes, it will. And to that point, a major priority of this administration will be, in conjunction with Elon Musk and the Department of Government Efficiency and Donald
Doge.
Trump himself,
yeah.
And Doge, yeah, and the House of Representatives, they will implement through reconciliation a number of energy policies, a number of changes to the regulatory environment and the approval process of pipelines. And absolutely, you better believe that Donald Trump is already having conversations with private enterprise and the like industry to say, my administration is going to be open and engaged with you. We aren't going to shun you and say that you're anti-American or that you're destroying the globe. We are going to be a friend and ally to building things in this country once again, and you're going to be the leaders of that. So, yes, I think he's having those conversations probably today.
One last quick thing, Ryan. I'm talking to Ryan Walker from Heritage Action. I'd love it if an awful lot of this was going to companies and saying, we want you to build pipelines. Don't look for federal money. We're kind of broke right now. But if you think this makes financial sense, we're ready to help clear the deck so you can get it done. But we'd like to get it done without spending a lot of the public's money. And if it doesn't make financial sense, we probably shouldn't be doing it. You got about 20 seconds.
No, absolutely. I think that's exactly what Donald Trump is saying. I don't think he's looking for subsidies for these organizations or companies. I think he's looking at real value, providing benefit to the American people. Where there is a monetary gain to be made in this country, private enterprise should be doing it. And Donald Trump will champion that.
And if it doesn't make sense, don't do it. Not, it doesn't make any sense for the government to back only the stupid investments that don't pay off. That's Ryan Walker. Ryan, thanks very much.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Moment counts if you're...
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now...
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
I mean, that's a special kind of stupid.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
I am asking you to be excited.
Honestly provocative talk radio.
It's never too early to learn that the government is a greedy piglet that suckles on a taxpayer's teat until they have sore, chapped nipples.
Lars.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
No, here's your host.
Wait a minute, I'm talking now, if you don't mind, please.
Lars Larson. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. One of the issues we've talked about literally on this program for years is the mutilation of children in the name of transgenderism. I've taken a hard and fast position against it. We've talked about it for years. I've talked about the billions of dollars that healthcare facilities and doctors are making by mutilating children, both mutilating them with drugs like puberty blockers that sterilize kids, hormone replacement, and then, of course, sex change surgeries. Now, adults can do all kinds of crazy things. I don't want to be controlling that, but I'm not in favor of the taxpayers paying for it for certain. But when it comes to kids, it should be hands off, do no harm. Well, Elizabeth Mitchell joins me now, who's the reporting fellow for the Daily Signal and co-host of the Daily Signal podcast. Elizabeth, tell me this. Are some of America's top business CEOs behind the flood of hospitals that seem happy to mutilate kids under the guise of transgenderism?
That seems to be correct. So there is a list of executives at some of the largest companies in America. These include Procter & Gamble, Costco, T-Mobile, Kroger, and the like. And they have top executives who are on the board of children's hospitals that do these irreversible transgender medical interventions for children that you've been talking about. And so they are, you know, in response, they're kind of complicit with these transgender procedures that are being done for kids. And so a campaign was launched today by Consumers Research to call those companies and call those executives to take a stand against something which is clearly wrong.
Well, and in fact, if you're named to a board of directors, I don't sit on any board of directors. I sit on one. It's a nonprofit, the Crime Prevention Research Center, and it's an uncompensated position. But I would imagine that some of these executives are already well paid by Costco, General Motors, T-Mobile, and the others you named, and then they sit on a board of directors for hospital systems or healthcare organizations, and I would imagine some of them get paid for that as well. Is that the case? Do we know?
I'm not sure about that. I think it's unclear here if these executives necessarily even support these sex changes for kids, but I think it is hard to believe that they could be on these boards and be unaware that this is happening.
Well,
and if they are aware this is happening, they're responsible to do something.
I mean, because, Elizabeth, if you're the CEO of a big company or a top executive at one of these companies, and you also have been given, say, the honor of serving on a board of directors, I would hope that you would take that seriously because you understand this is about people's health, that if you're sitting on that board and you start to hear all this concern that's been in the popular press as well as on conservative talk radio, that you might go to your next board meeting and say, we're not doing any of this stuff, are we? And if they're not asking that question, they're not doing the very thing that you would expect of an executive of a top company. I mean, if you're an executive at General Motors and there's talk of, say, EV mandates and things like that, I would imagine you'd say, are we doing that? Are we required to do that? And if you've agreed to be on the board of directors of a healthcare institution, that you might not naturally say, are we doing that kind of thing? Are they simply not asking the questions?
I hope that this campaign, that raising awareness about the fact that they're on these boards, will cause these men to take a stand for what is right, take a stand for kids, for parents, and for these kids, their long-term health, and say, no, sex changes for kids are wrong. This is mutilation of children, like you said. So I really hope that raising awareness about this issue will cause those executives, like you said, to go to their boards and say, you've got to stop this or I'm going to step down.
Yeah, and not just step down, but make some noise about it. Because otherwise, if these boards of hospitals are made up of people who, in some cases, I do know that boards of directors generally are paid. They're not paid as well as Hunter Biden got paid on the natural gas company in Ukraine, but you get a fairly big check if you're, say, on the board of directors of General Motors or Costco or T-Mobile or Procter & Gamble. Those usually pay pretty good bucks. And maybe you're doing the, you know, service on a board of directors for a hospital because it's an honor for you. And of course, the hospital says, look who's on our board of directors. They get some benefit by having big names on their board of directors. And if they're just expected to walk in and rubber stamp everything that comes in front of them, then you're really not serving as a board member, are you?
You're totally right. These men really do have a moral imperative to stand up against this radical gender ideology and this idea that it's okay to tell kids that they're born in the wrong body and to alter their bodies in response to feelings that very likely might go away when they get older. So you're totally right. These men do need to take a stand. They need to go to their boards and they need to say this needs to stop. And it's really great to see a campaign like this raising awareness about these hospitals doing these surgeries and about, you know, mainstream executives being complicit, because this is something that really all the stops need to be pulled out on in order to end gender transitions for kids.
Well, and in fact, Elizabeth, I don't know if you have better numbers or newer numbers than I have, but the last time I saw, I believe by 2025, the estimate was that healthcare institutions and doctors and nurses were going to make around $5 billion on transgender care of one kind or another. I almost don't want to call it care because it is mutilating kids. And it's doing it in ways when they're not old enough to make the decision on their own. They're not adults for a reason. And our society treats children differently than it treats adults. And the healthcare institutions are making amazing amounts of money on this, aren't they?
You're totally right. There is a huge financial incentive for these hospitals regarding these gender transitions. In most cases, this is not something insurance covers because it is not necessary. I think you're totally right to not want to call it care because it really is not care. They call it gender affirming care. What it really is lying to a child about their, you know, biological sex and then altering their body in an unnecessary way that they're going to live with the repercussions for the rest of their lives. And you're totally correct on that.
Well, I'll tell you what, my first inclination is talk to my producers, make some calls myself, and see if we can get one or two of these board members to come on and say, are you on the board? Are you aware your healthcare system is doing this kind of thing? Are you okay with that? And if you are, why? Elizabeth, thank you very much. That's Elizabeth Mitchell from the Daily Signal. Elizabeth, we really appreciate the time. Hey, I've got a little word of advice for you about something I use every single day, and that's Gedify shoes. I'm standing in them right now. And did I buy them with my own money? Yep. Do I spend my money on something that doesn't work? No, I don't. I'm convinced that Gedify shoes are the right shoes for people like me who stand on their feet 12 or 13 hours a day. Gedify shoes come with patented VersaSock technology. Gedify doesn't just talk about comfort. They engineer it in, and I found that out the first time I tried on a pair and said, let me see how I feel about this after I've been standing in them for 12 hours. I loved them. So does my wife. Gedify shoes absorb those harmful shocks. They really help you stand tall. Go to Gedify.com and use my name, Lars, for $20 off on orders of $100 or more. I'm convinced you'll have the same impression I did when I let Tina try mine on, even though they're the wrong size. She said, I need two pair. That's code word Lars for $20 off on orders over $100, because even champions need to rest. Go to G-D-E-F-Y, Gedify.com today.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. Comes Brutal Honesty, whether you like it or not, with Lars Larson You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. After years of bloated bureaucracy and runaway regulation, could Donald Trump's victory finally take down the deep state? Well, the guy who's got an insight into that is Bob Barr, former member of the U.S. Congress, former CIA analyst, and now the president of the NRA. Bob, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Lars. Probably posed the most important question for our nation's future, and that is, can Trump take down the deep state? It'll take a while, probably beyond his first term, well, his current term, but he has already made a damn good start?
Yeah, you can say that. And by the way, Bob, if part of this is, and I know Biden undid this, but Trump made it possible to fire federal employees, which I thought was especially important with literal life and death situations like the VA. VA is populated by a bunch of non-military. Some are former military, but many of them are just civilian employees, and they were essentially unfireable. Trump made them fireable. Biden undid that. Is it possible we could get the U.S. Congress to say you can fire people for not doing their job?
It is possible. It's tough, but part of it you can do through just executive order to make it permanent. You have to have a change to the law. But I'll tell you, the 1-2 punch that could really start accomplishing that would be with Peter Hegseth as defense and yep. to get somebody who is similarly minded and with backbone as head of the VA. That would do it.
Well, why can you explain, as a former member of Congress, why is it so hard if you go to the people's representatives and say you employ a couple of million people, you've got all these people working in the federal government, when they don't do their jobs, should we be able to fire them? Well, all of these people who are citizens, who are voters, who are your constituents, are people, I don't know very many of them, who work in a job where they say, yeah, doesn't matter how big I screw up, I can't be fired. There probably are a few people like that through family connections or some other reason. But for the most part, everybody in America except government employees can be fired, for especially when they don't do their jobs.
Well, one of the reasons that I like and love staying in Georgia, my home state now for many, many decades, is not only because we have government officials that understand and protect the Second Amendment, but because it's a right-to-work state, which means that you can hire and fire at will. But the problem, the history that led to the problem you just identified is thanks to the so-called progressive Republicans at the turn of the last century, the late 19th century, the start of the 20th century, when Republicans in cahoots with Woodrow Wilson later on decided that they would make it very difficult to fire anybody in the federal government because of the old patronage system. So the history of this goes back to Republicans, but you know, Trump has already made clear through his words in these early appointments that he's serious about that, among other efforts to clean up the deep state. But I mean, what the deep state has done to veterans for decades is just unconscionable.
Well, I know, because at the time we talked about all these examples where there were doctors and other doctors, nurses, other staff who worked at the VA who literally hid veterans and said, you're on a waiting list, you'll get to see a doctor eventually. And some of those veterans died while they were waiting, literally died. And at least in the short term, even if they didn't die, they were denied the medical care to which they were entitled. But Bob, why should anybody in the federal government be able to say, I have a job for life, nobody can fire me? It's one thing to say, well, you don't walk in and fire the entire workforce, the entire federal workforce, every time there's a change of administration. But to have people, it offends me as a taxpayer that I pay my taxes, I can be fired from my job. Why can't federal employees be fired from their job? And then just make it clear, you can't just simply fire somebody over politics, but you have to say, we don't need you anymore, go away. You've done a bad job, we're firing you, we're sending you back to the private sector. And by the way, we're not just going to transfer you from one agency to another agency and pass the trash, but we're actually going to fire you and say, you've done a bad job and we don't want you working in the government. You can go back and try to find a job somewhere else.
There's absolutely no reason for that other than the entrenched bureaucracy and the lack of backbone by successive Republican and Democrat presidents and congressional leaders over the years. We now have, though, the best situation, the best possibility that we've ever had, because you have a president coming in, President Trump, who's been there. He knows the mistakes that he made. He knows what to do this time, and he doesn't have to worry about being reelected. He can say to, you know what, with all of you, we are going to change this. I am going to change it, and you can do nothing about it to hurt me. So we're going to be on January 21st, the 20th, actually, he can start in a perfect position that we've never been in before to do this.
Well, and in fact, I would love it if immediately after he signs an executive order, if his staff goes to the members of Congress on Capitol Hill that will do, you know, what he suggests, say, okay, introduce a bill and make it very simple and very short that if you're not doing your job, you can be fired. And if your job is no longer necessary, you can be fired. Because otherwise, you're really telling American citizens that if you work in the government, you have some kind of special privilege to be employed forever. And nobody, almost nobody in the private sector is that way. Folks at CNN found that out this week. I guess a bunch of them are going to get their pink slips.
Well, the market system does eventually work. But unfortunately, our federal government, because of these structural legal provisions that they have, isn't in the marketplace out there. But he needs to change that, and I think he will. And I think we have, at least right now and for the next 2 years, as long as we can hang on to these two majorities in the Congress, we have the opportunity to do so. The American people have spoken. Now we need to have the congressional leaders actually do what the electorate told them to do on November 5th.
You know what I'd love to have, Bob, because for all the people who, and Donald Trump has also talked about having a constitutional amendment to have term limits on members of the House and Senate, and I could ask you about that, and feel free to give me your opinion. But what I'd love to have, I've told people, I'd like to see a term limit on federal employment. If you're working, especially if you're working in the management ranks, you can be here for, and then pick a number, 10 years, 12 years, 8 years, whatever number you want. And you say, well, what am I supposed to do when that time limit is up? Go back to the private sector. If you're any good, you'll get a very nice paycheck, maybe even a raise by going from the government to the private sector. Many of the jobs in the federal government, the equivalent in the private sector, pays more. And if you say, but I don't have any skills for the private sector, well, then we definitely don't want you working in the government. We need to get rid of you. What would you think of a term limits on federal employment and say there is no more lifetime federal employment?
Well, and it ought to also apply to congressional staff. That's a problem that I noted when I was in the Congress, is the staff out for the committees, they outlast the members, so they can just sit back and wait. The place that you start with what you've just talked about is with the senior executive service, which went into place during the Carter administration. So you have your top level federal employees, not political appointees, but career people. They get special pay, extra pay and benefits, and those are the ones that you start with. You start with them and say, okay, you don't perform, then you're at least going to get kicked back down to the regular civil service. You're not going to get these perks. That's where I think you can start, because that's a lot easier.
Well, in fact, the other model I kind of like for that, Bob, is up or out, like the military. Okay, you come in, I'm going to be, now, sergeants and NCOs is a little bit different, but if you say, I'm just going to be a lieutenant for the rest of my career, no, you either move up and show that you got capability, or you move out, and that freshens the ranks on a regular basis. I'd love to see that in the federal government. You want to move up from a low-level manager to a top-level manager? Great. When you get to that top level and you're not moving up anymore, you got a few years and then you need to get out, go back to the private sector, and we'll pull in some fresh talent from the private sector that actually knows what it's like in the real world, unlike the world of the federal government. That's Bob Barr, former member of Congress, now the elected president of the NRA. Back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show. Join the best conversation in talk journalism at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. But first, I want to talk to Bill Jacobson. He's one of our go-tos when it comes to legal matters. He's the founder of the law blog called Legal Insurrection, a clinical professor of law and director of the Securities Law Clinic at Cornell Law School. Professor Jacobson, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Would you mind telling my audience why a proposed referendum on so-called abortion rights, I don't think there is a right to abortion, but we can debate that another day, is going to end up discriminating, strangely, against Asian American students who are trying to get a good spot in a high school? How do those two tie together? Where's the nexus?
Yeah, well, so New York Proposition 1, which is not actually named the Equal Rights Amendment, but that's what the proponents refer to it as, was passed in a hurry, supposedly to protect abortion rights in New York State, right after the Supreme Court decision on abortion striking down Roe. But they stuck all this other stuff in there. And in fact, the amendment doesn't even mention abortion. And so to the New York State Constitution, which previously protected race, creed, color, and religion, they have added gender identity and a whole bunch of other things that are causing kind of a parents' movement revolt in New York State, protecting girls' sports, et cetera. But there's a second provision that we're really the ones who first called attention to it, which is very bizarrely worded. It says that basically all of the other rights that are protected do not prohibit actions, programs, you know, rules that discriminate in order to dismantle discrimination. So basically what it says, if your goal is to dismantle discrimination, you can discriminate against anybody. That's commonly referred to as reverse racism. The
yeah.
Asian community is extremely concerned that that will be used to discriminate against Asian students in the elite New York City public schools. So like Bronx High School of Science, Stuyvesant High School are extremely difficult to get into. And there are lawsuits flying all over the place because people are trying to do there what they did at Harvard and other places is, you know, manipulate the racial balance to minimize the number of Asian students. And they are concerned that if this becomes a provision in the New York State Constitution that you can discriminate in order to dismantle discrimination, that that's going to hurt them and it'll be used against the Asians. So we joined up Equal Protection Project, which we run with a very large Chinese American and Asian American group in New York City. And we're jointly opposing this, saying people, they're slipping this in. Nobody's paying attention to it. They talk about abortion, but first of all, abortion's not threatened in New York State. I mean, it's extraordinarily liberal abortion laws. And so what they're doing is they're using abortion to slip all this other stuff in, the gender stuff, and also reverse discrimination. So that's where the Asian connection comes in, is that community believes this will be used against them.
And it probably will. And in fact, Professor, from a distance, I've been to New York City, but I've never lived there. And I've always admired their public schools because they said to public school students, if you go out and you do the hard homework, which doesn't have to cost any money, it just means a lot of skull sweat and reading books and, you know, making sure you're prepared, you can pass these exams and get into these elite public high schools, not private schools, but they at least perform. If your goal is to graduate from high school with a really great education and maybe in a path to a top university, these public high schools do that, but they are based on merit. If you can pass the test or if you do well on the test, you get in. If you don't, you don't. And it's like a lot of other things in life. If you're really good at something, you end up in the NBA or you end up in a physics lab somewhere. And if you're not very good at it, you do something else. But this has benefited the Chinese American community to a tremendous degree because they tell their kids, you're going to study hard. You're going to pass those tests. And you're going to get into Bedford Stuy or you're going to get into, you know, the Bronx School. And all of this. Why in the world that city could take a system that actually benefits people who are often the kids of blue-collar parents, you know, who can't afford the private school? You say, here's a way for them to get in, but you have to get in based on merit. And now they want to dismantle that because they say there aren't enough brown and black kids and we've got too many Asian kids?
That's exactly right. I mean, these were schools where you tested in. Everybody took the same test, and the students who scored the highest on the test got accepted. And they've been trying to change that. And like I said, there's a lawsuit that was filed by various Asian groups because essentially the, 60 to 70% of these schools were ending up being Asian in the broadest sense. That would include Indian, Korean, Chinese. I mean, in the broadest sense, Asian, it's ending up being 60, 70%. And the liberals in New York City don't like that. And so they were taking it out on the Asian students, just like Harvard did, just like, Thomas Jefferson High School in Virginia did, just like Boston Latin School did. I mean, people need to understand this whole movement at these elite public schools is really anti-Asian. I mean, that's what it's geared towards. It's let's open up spots for other people who don't perform as well because there are too many Asians there. And that's what it comes down to. And that's why the Asian community is joining us in objecting to this provision that allows reverse discrimination.
Well, let me ask you this, Professor. I know this gets outside of the law and it gets more into the psychology of all this. I can understand why the Asian community is unhappy with this. But are the Black and Hispanic communities happy that they're being told, we're going to get you into the school even if your kids aren't really smart enough or well-studied enough to be able to get into the school? Because that seems like an insult that, we're going to put you in as a token representative based on your skin color, even though you don't match up academically to these other kids. Is the Black community really saying, yeah, that's a great deal for us?
I can't say, I don't have a good sense of the community, but these are the activists driving it, okay? So these are various, nonprofit groups. These are various political activists who are driving this. I don't know whether or not the Black community as a whole has a position on this, but certainly the racial activists are the ones behind the discrimination against, Asian students. And, white liberals, frankly, who drive a lot of this diversity, equity, and inclusion stuff is very much a white liberal movement pretending to be the, the savior of other people. So I don't know how much the Black community itself is upset about this, but the activists are.
Am I right in guessing that a lot of these white liberals who are pushing so hard to start monkeying with all this stuff and say, we want to change the racial composition, even though the racial composition could change if those other students from the other demographic groups just said, I'm going to sit down and study hard and I'll get in on my own merits? Because I'm trying to imagine the young Black kid or Hispanic kid who really did study hard and got in on his smarts. If they make these changes, he's going to walk into schools where probably both the teachers and his fellow students are going to say, oh, yeah, you're here not because you're smart, not because you did well on the test. You're here because they carved out a slot for you.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the points that was made in the Supreme Court decision on affirmative action, is that these sort of programs reinforce and perpetuate negative stereotypes.
Yep.
So if your presumption is because of the color of someone's skin alone, that in and of itself makes them deficient, that they need extra help, that's extremely racist. That's a negative stereotype. And so, yeah, I think that's part of the problem, is that these, fighting racism or perceived racism with more racism is never really the answer. And so that is a problem. And the way they're doing it is they're, changing the testing. They're doing away with test only. They're trying to introduce so-called soft factors. And remember, Harvard in the 1920s was the pioneer of the soft factors, and they used those soft factors to keep Jews out. And
exactly so. Professor Jacobson, thanks very much. That's Bill Jacobson. You can find him at the law blog called Legal Insurrection. You find him in the classroom at Cornell Law School. And you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the best of The Lars Larson Show.
Getting
can't get enough Lars? Follow him on Twitter at Lars Larson Show. You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on the 11th day of the 11th month. And I know that United States Air Force Brigadier General, now retired, Blaine Holt, Well, I would imagine you remember Veterans Day fondly. For all the veterans out there who've served, including I was not in the service, but my mother and father were. General Hold, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be back. And, you know, when people come up to me and they say, Lars, thank you for your service, we love that. But I love to say back, thank you for your taxpayer dollars and all my adventures, because it was a great run. And I love flying those jets. And it was 135 countries and a lot of incredible women and men to work with. I would always recommend military service, even more so now.
Absolutely. And General, I have to tell you, one of the biggest thrills of my life was sitting in the back seat. They do have a model with the back seat and of a F-18 Hornet with the Blue Angels, and got a chance to go flying. And those were some dollars well spent, I hope. But it was, and by the way, I called them up, a couple of years ago, and they said, nope, it's once to a lifetime, and you do not get a second chance to go do it. But I want to know whether or not you think America's veterans are being treated right. Have they for the last 4 years, especially, and will they be treated differently come January of next year?
Yeah, no, this administration that we've just experienced went to work immediately on reversing all of the reforms that President Trump had put onto the Veterans Administration. And, you know, Lars, it only takes about 30 days to send the United States military to war. But when we go to that war, when we come back, so many of us need help in all kinds of ways. It's not just a PTSD world out there. It's, hey, my arm doesn't work anymore. And to go through red tape, to watch doctors that have been sent to the southern border to look after illegal invaders, that's just unconscionable. And look at the homeless problem that we've got with vets. And it doesn't have to be that way at all. In fact, it's a national embarrassment. But hopefully and optimistically, I say that the VA is going to see a new day. Reforms will get back on track. And we're going to see a team over there that's going to be truly interested in putting their hearts and souls into it. And I'm not saying there's not good people there now. It's just that they're not allowed to execute their mission the way they should be.
Well, General, what happens, though, when Americans see that college campuses, some of them private, but many of them public as well, seem to have no use for veterans at all and won't even recognize the importance of recognizing veterans on Veterans Day?
Yeah, that's fine. I like President Trump's plan for changing the accreditation program, which scrutinizes if institutions like that should be getting our dollars. You know, 1% of our population serves in uniform voluntarily. All we ask is that you support us when we do. And if it's going to be okay for college campuses to teach that those men and women who wear the uniform are the enemy, well, I have a solution. Pull your accreditation, and you don't get any of our taxpayer dollars, and you can go study whatever studies program you want to study. But it's very clear that we're going to see this next 4 years be a season of reform, and it'll happen in higher education. I'm all for it.
I mean, the story I was looking at in particular, General, I'm talking to United States Air Force Brigadier General Blaine Holt, now retired. But Columbia University, which the last time I checked gets about $600 million from the United States Congress, and they're a very well-endowed university. They have lots and lots of money in the bank, and yet they get close to two-thirds of $1 billion every year from the American taxpayers. And on their campus, you had protesters saying, we're going to celebrate Martyrs Day, Martyrs of Gaza, meaning criminals, meaning terrorists, and they're going to mark that on Veterans Day as a counterpoint to honoring American veterans. These kids don't get it, and apparently the people around them at the university don't get it either.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Just don't pay for it. And if Columbia is struggling, well, maybe there's some space in Qatar or Iran or some other place that might be much more amenable to those types of studies. But what I love is that we're going to go into a season of accountability, I believe. And you can't just, again, look at what happened under the, I'm using air quotes, Affordable Care Act. What nobody really knows is that they took the student loan program and subsidized it into the government, so the government backed all those loans. Well, guess what? All the paychecks for all those liberal professors went skyrocketing. and now they can do whatever they want and say whatever they want. Well, pull it. Pull the money. Pull the programs. Make these things earn on their own merit. And if Columbia is such a good school, as good as my University of Georgia, well, then prove it. But right now, the proof isn't there, because I don't see anything of somebody who hires people out of the Ivy League that is truly exceptional. In fact, it's quite the opposite.
Hey, General, I want you to tell people this, because I don't think it gets repeated much at all anymore, and that is that the Air Force has something called the Community College of the Air Force. So if a young man or woman said, I really want to go to college, I want to go to a good college, but I can't afford it, and I don't want to dive into a whole bunch of debt, you could go out and sign up for military service. You could go into the Air Force. Doesn't mean you'd end up as a jet pilot, but you'd have some other worthy job. And you could school yourself while you're in the Air Force and then come out of it. I think it's still true. GI Bill would cover the 4 years at a four-year college if they wanted to, as one of the benefits they get as a veteran for having served a hitch. Am I wrong about any of that?
No, it's one of the greatest things about our nation is that you could go into the military, any service, as a one striper, and you can end up as a four-star general or an admiral one day, but it doesn't even have to be that. I know tons of enlisted folks who got out, they didn't really even want to finish a college degree. They went and got their pilot's licenses. They're flying for Delta Airlines now. Some have started businesses. They're entrepreneurs. They've learned how to sweat payroll. But what is great is that if you go into the military and you apply yourself, it's an American story. You can transform you and your family for the future. And I think it's one of the greatest things. That's why I'm so excited about the meritocracy coming back, DEI Marxism going away, vaccine programs getting thrown away, and the accountability that comes with, and stupid decisions about when to send our best into combat being set aside in terms of let's get to a demilitarized foreign policy. That's keeping faith with the American serviceman and women.
Is there a way to set it right with all of the people who were in the service and were given the jab mandate and said, I'm not doing it, and they got booted, some of them just short of retirement? Is there a way to set that truly straight?
I think it's a two-track plan, Lars. I think, one, you treat it as a general liability. The government wronged these people, and those things need to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis quickly, rapidly, and those people need to be made whole. If it's financial, okay, fine. For the ones that are able and want to and have the heart to come back, restore their careers, put them back on track, and put them into a military that needs them very badly.
General, real quick, have you had a call from the new commander-in-chief? Is he pulling you back for any kind of duty?
Well, I have not had a call from him personally, but I have had some interesting discussions, and, I love discussions.
Okay, we're looking forward to that. That is General Holt, U.S. Air Force Brigadier General Blaine Holt. Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the best of the Lars Larson Show. The Lars Larson Show.
Looking for a new way to give back?